Hey everybody, I'm Andrew Mall, and today I'm here with Jonathan from Hackers and Founders. Hey Jonathan.
Hi, I'm Jonathan from Hackers and Founders. Welcome.
Thanks for tuning in. So Jonathan, what is Hackers and Founders and how did you get started there?
We are, if I'm not mistaken, one of the largest groups of nerds building startups in the world. We started having events in a bar in Silicon Valley almost 10 years ago, and it was Hackers and Founders. It was me and five other people talking about startups, and people liked the event, so we had another one. And there were 12 people, and we had another one, and there were 18 people, and another one, and 23 and 32. And at this point, Hackers and Founders events have been held in 115 cities, 45 countries, and I believe a quarter of a million people. Last count, about 9 months ago, a quarter of a million people have attended Hackers and Founders events worldwide.
Small number.
A little bit.
Pretty casual.
A little bit. Yeah, pretty chill.
A few people.
Primarily we, you know, get together, we network, some of our groups have speakers, like today we're doing a big, you know, AI day, here in San Francisco. And then how do you essentially turn that into a business? It wasn't supposed to be a business.
Mm-hmm.
But what we actually found was that there were tons and tons of entrepreneurs from around the world, coming to Silicon Valley, coming to one of our events because they're like, hey, I'm a hacker, I'm a founder, and they're having an event in a bar, so I'll go. And people would come to me and say, hey, Jonathan, hey, I'm here, I'm visiting, I'm working on this startup. And I'm like, cool, here's a beer. They're like, what do you do? And I'm like, well, I'm a nurse 3 nights a week, 4 nights a week, I'm building a search engine for financial news in my spare time, and then I have these events 1 night a month. And they're like, okay, you're a nurse? I'm like, yes. Mm-hmm. And I just got really sick of seeing startups come here from all over the world. They might have like a 3-month tourist visa. They'd struggle to try to find funding in 3 months. You know, who do I connect to? Who do I talk to? Where do I go? Who do I see? Who should I talk to? And I started asking around to like investors, like, hey, y'all should help these people out. And through those conversations, one of those investors suggested very strongly that we start an accelerator after introducing him to a bunch of our companies. I laughed because I was working as a nurse, programming 4 nights a week. I'd done most of an engineering degree. And but we have since started a founders cooperative where we work with startups over the long term. They pay common stock into a shared equity pool, so they own part of the pool, we own part of the pool, and then half of the pool we sell to pay for our team's salaries and build a community and that sort of stuff. And they, we've now worked with about 55 companies in that founders cooperative.
Okay.
They're worth about $500 million right now. They've raised about $60 million in capital, and we've had 5 exits so far.
Congratulations.
Well, thanks.
That's pretty good.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Not
a little different, than nursing. A
little bit. Although, it's shockingly, there's a lot of stuff that's kind of carried over.
Like what?
For years, I used to walk into patients' room and say, hi, what hurts? How can I help you? I didn't really know how to do anything else with our first group of companies that this investor had picked for us. And we just sat down and was like, hey, this guy is telling us to start an incubator. I don't know what the hell I'm doing, but we're supposed to help each other out. So let's talk about what sucks, what hurts. I don't know how to build a better white label video hosting site for enterprise, but if we talk about what sucks, at minimum, we feel better. We have a drink, we have a good meal.
Yeah.
And best case scenario, I probably know someone who can help because I do run a very large networking group. And it still works. I talk a lot with our portfolio companies about what sucks, what hurts. I never knew the secret to having a person live to be 110 years old. And what I did learn is, you know, if someone doesn't die of a heart attack when they're 45, they tend to get older.
Yeah.
If they don't die of a pneumonia, they get older. With startups, if they don't die, they tend to grow and get bigger. So I tend to worry a lot about what kills companies.
Okay.
So I think that's kind of like emergency room nursing, but for companies.
All right.
It's kind of the same thing.
That's weird. I've never thought of it that way.
Nobody really does. I've always been kind of a problem child.
Oh, it's worked.
Yeah, you know, why not?
What are some of those pitfalls that you keep seeing?
You know what?
Kill those startups.
No, absolutely. 30% of our companies, the founding teams have broken up and split up. And when that happens, it tends to be something of a divorce, which means there's two people who spend a lot of time together and their money's really tied up together and they want to break up. And lawyers get involved and they're very angry at each other. And then they go out and get drunk and nobody's happy for a year. And I call that a divorce. So
pretty close. I mean, exactly kind of what
happens.
It's
a founder divorce. Hear, right? And so one of the things that we do, my wife is my co-founder at Hackers and Founders. And we've just decided we offer co-founder counseling for our companies. Mm-hmm. We'll have people go to like communication classes, and so many problems are, you know, we didn't talk about hard questions like who gets paid what, or how the equity splits, or I'd really like you to do more work, honey. Like, I'm doing all the dishes in this company, and I need you to also do the floors and the dishes so that the work is a little bit more equal. It's that kind of stuff that if you don't talk about it, just kind of blows a company up. But it's weird. Like, no one ever talks about that. You don't blog about, like, oh, my God, my founder and I, we had such a great conversation today. We really touched, we really connected. We came to agreement and da-da-da. You know, they would much rather say, oh, this is how I raised $5 million in 30 minutes.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
That's a blog post that sells. Working through, like, hard crap, like, difficult personality issues is... That's kind of where we live day to day.
Yeah, and I think a lot of founders kind of, they have this company, they work on it together, then all of a sudden it's a big thing and it becomes real.
Yep.
And all that work's already happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, you see it in every startup kind of has that, whether it's Snapchat or Facebook.
Or Yelp. The founding team almost broke up when Google offered to acquire Yelp. One of them wanted to take the acquisition. One of them wanted to go an IPO. Mm-hmm. So that was a really rough 6 months.
Yeah.
Acquisition didn't happen, the IPO did, but so that's one of the problems that they find. I also find that when I was a nurse, I asked one of my instructors, what kills a person when they die of cancer?
Mm-hmm.
And I had stumped her, and I was like, why is she stumped? And she's like, well, okay, so if a cancer spreads to the liver, it starts to create toxins, and eventually, well, if it spreads to the brain, and well, if it spreads to the lungs and you can't breathe, but well, eventually people die because their heart stops. But there's about 50 different reasons that someone's heart would stop in cancer. And I was like, oh. And so I started thinking about that in terms of startups. What is the heart of a startup? And I think it's like the founders' wills to continue. And if founders just give up, then the company tends to die. Common reasons for founders giving up are family issues, getting sick and tired of not paying the rent and not having enough money for food, like being broke. Like
ramen noodles and beans and rice.
When you're really tired of the beans, rice, and ramen, then at that point you want to do something else. So one of the things we do with our companies, it's kind of old school, but we're like, hey, why don't you sell stuff? Why don't you grow revenue? I would much rather help our companies get to $1 million in revenue than raise $1 million in capital. Just because if you have $1 million in revenue, it's going to be much easier for you to raise capital.
Yeah.
So
I think that's a really good advice now in Valley, especially. Like, there seems to be a little bit harder to raise money recently.
Yep.
Having revenues is something you can point to and be like, yeah, we have revenue. We need this or that.
And when you have revenue, usually you have a way to continue paying the rent and continue paying salaries. And, you know, you have a lot more wiggle room and you're not kind of constantly in crisis survival mode.
It's exhausting.
Yeah, it's completely exhausting. Been there, done that, have many t-shirts. So what else kills companies? You know what? Honestly, those are like the biggest things that I focus on. You know, like, again, ear nurse, I learned after 20 years that there's really three very important priorities in life: keeping your airway open, breathing, and making sure your blood is circulating. Truly, everything else in life is a detail to those three things. Yeah. Your job is to breathe and move blood around your body. When that doesn't happen, things go very badly very quickly. And so I tend to think of it as, you know, money in the bank. Make sure that you're paying yourself, your bills, your salary, making sure that you're doing right by the customer. Hopefully selling a product instead of selling hourly services, mm-hmm. because the only way to grow on hourly services is to grow more hours in your life. Yeah. And that's really hard.
You can't. Hours in, hours out.
Pretty
Everyone
much.
Gets the same.
Yep.
It's how you use them.
Yep.
And do you have a rule on that? I hear a lot of people talk about, like, you should have a product company, and if you have a product company, you can do services, but, you know, I hear a lot of, like, this 80-20, 20% of your revenue should come from services, 80% from products. Do you?
You know, a lot of it depends on the business and the place that you're actually selling in. Mm-hmm. I think services are very interesting. If I can bundle a software product, if a software product plus 20 hours a month of services for one set price.
Yeah.
And if you want more services, well, then that's going to cost you a premium. That's really interesting. It's really hard to not kind of feel the allure of selling more services because
well, it's right now. You get the cash.
It's immediate, it's cash. And I like choosing limitations as a founder.
Okay.
At one point in time, I thought I wanted to be an artist, but I sucked. And so, but what I did learn is that if I tried to make a painting with acrylics or charcoal, it was hard to paint with charcoal, but if you made a drawing with charcoal or paint with acrylics, that choice is going to lead you in very different directions. I actually like choosing limitations as a founder. For instance, we've chosen to grow Hackers and Founders without operating and optimizing for a venture fund with a management fee. I don't take management fees. We don't take management fees. So we've had to invent a new fund structure to form our founders cooperative. That's actually forced us to do a lot more innovating and be a lot more creative when there is kind of an easy standard answer to this problem. But I don't want my company to essentially look like yet another venture capital fund.
Yeah.
And we have this huge community that we have to, you know, put first. And what do we do that's in the best interest of the community? And so I think just choosing a limitation, saying I'm going to force my company to exist based on selling product. If I can't sell enough product or if I'm not making enough money on product, maybe you should look at how much you're charging for the product.
Yeah.
Try tripling the price and see what happens.
Yeah, I've heard some interesting things. You triple the price and you still get the same amount of complaints,
mm-hmm.
but they just complain. And that really tells you that you have a good product.
Yep.
Right? If people are willing to pay for it,
yep.
I don't know. I complain about spending any money.
Absolutely.
But if I really need something, mm-hmm. I'm going to pay for that.
Yep.
And it's funny you talk about limitations too. Mm-hmm. Steven Spielberg does something very similar. Mm-hmm. When he creates mm-hmm. Movies, mm-hmm. he actually sets a set budget. The guy doesn't need a budget for anything,
yep.
but he says that's how he is able to actually innovate and make creative things and go further
yep.
is because he has those limitations.
And I actually think that it's the limitations that force us to innovate and force us to be creative. I think that's one of the reasons why startups tend to be so scrappy is because you start off with really no resources.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's actually a problem, again, heresy. I think there's actually problems when startups get overcapitalized.
Okay.
I think having too much money is a problem that nobody really talks about. But I don't know of too many software companies in the world that can spend $100 million just developing software.
That would be tough. That's a lot of people.
That's a ton of engineers.
Ton of people.
Like, how would I manage an engineering team of 1,000 people?
Yeah.
Like, that's a nightmare. Uh-huh. Like, I mean, engineers, we're all nerds and we're a pain in the ass and that's what we do. But how do you actually build and ship code if that many people have their fingers in the stew? I don't know.
Oh.
And I take my hat off to organizations that can. But if you are not selling something fast enough that you need $100 million to be able to build the new features that do sell, I think there's a big problem. Like most of the startups that I hear about that raise huge rounds like that, how they end up scaling is they either build out a sales force or they acquire other startups.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's fine. You know, acquisitions are great. We've had a couple startups like that. But I think there's a risk of, I don't like the idea of startups having too much money because I actually like being hungry as an organization.
And I mean, you create cash flyers, you buy nice art, you buy fancy buildings and all of that, like employee morale is very, very important, but there's a fine line between excess spending and making sure that you have enough engineers that want to work for you.
I mean, I know that when I'm flush with cash, like my first thing is like, ooh, shiny. Well, I'm going to buy that. Ooh, shiny. And I'm going to buy this and shiny. And not that shiny things are bad. I just, I don't know. I think hunger focuses people.
Absolutely. And so now with Hackers and Founders, mm-hmm. you're also getting the ability to work a little bit in Washington, right?
So being the largest group of nerds building startups, you end up doing some weird things. Like a friend of yours, who's a Caltech aerospace engineer, says, I don't want to be an engineer, Jonathan. I want to be a politician. What problem can I solve for startups? And I'm like, immigration? He's like, okay, I'm going to solve immigration for startups. Craig, 3 months later, introduced me to the White House staffer in charge of immigration. I introduced me to Mayor Bloomberg's office on immigration. Apparently, it was news to them that if we could solve immigration for startup entrepreneurs, that thousands of people might come to the United States and build companies.
It's funny to hear, because in the Valley, that's not a novel. Like, most of my founder friends are finding it troublesome to be in the Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And they have companies employing tons of people.
I got sick of seeing, like, CEOs with employees getting deported, and I'm just like, this is bullshit.
Yeah.
And so we ended up just working on that in the background. We tried some political stuff. You know, obviously Congress is what Congress is. And so Craig has actually started a program called Entrepreneurs in Residence, where entrepreneurs get research fellowships at universities, which gives them a visa. So they volunteer or work at the university for 5 or 10 hours, like a fellow would, mm-hmm. and then they work the rest of the time on their company. And the first 23 visas in the last year and a half have actually gone out, 100% approval rate.
Great.
We submitted 80 pages of commentary to the Securities and Exchange Commission on what crowdfunding should look like to benefit thousands of 2- and 3-person companies. Apparently, they liked what we wrote because they quoted it in their regulations. And I'm now on an SEC committee that oversees crowdfunding and capital formation for small businesses.
It's really cool.
It's a little weird, you know. They forced me to wear a suit, so I got to take the shorts off and look presentable. But I think the only person in the SEC building with a ponytail.
Nice.
Which?
That is in itself a great accomplishment.
It's been really interesting, kind of the interesting in DC. Like, I'm in this weird place where if Hackers and Founders is going to be a sustainable, thriving company, I have to build a 20-year company.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm never going to IPO Hackers and Founders. I'm never going to be able to sell Hackers and Founders to someone else because it's network and relationship-based and, you know. And so we have to build a profitable, growing company. And so I think of what changes can we do now? If it takes me 20 years to do them, I'm cool with that. And that's really the time frame that you actually have to think about in terms of working with Washington, D.C.
Okay.
Like in Silicon Valley or in tech, like 18 months is a generation.
Yeah.
You know, like every 9 months, I need a new phone. And a lot of people get really impatient when something takes 9 months to get back to you and the process or the paperwork trail, you're like, screw you. I'm not, Washington sucks. But there's actually some really cool things happening and some really cool pockets of innovation that are happening in and around DC. We're talking with governments on how to grow startup communities overseas. Mexico is the second largest country for hackers and founders after the United States.
Okay.
Next week, they're going to a hackathon with 25,000 engineers in Guadalajara, Mexico. Guadalajara has more engineers than Ireland.
Wow.
Nobody thinks about that.
Yeah.
Nobody thinks of engineering talent in Latin America. They think of other things. And so the government asked us, for instance, to go down and teach wealthy families how to invest in entrepreneurs.
Hmm.
Like, okay.
Happy to, yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. So we brought a bunch of investors from Silicon Valley down and, you know, give them a business class ticket and a 5-star hotel and a room full of rich people to talk to about how to grow wealth by investing in a whole portfolio of entrepreneurs instead of investing in one company and asking for 80% of the company in exchange for $50,000. And teach them more, think broadly, think about doing the right thing for the entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. Building relationships with the entrepreneurs that can last for a decade or more. And the response was fantastic. So we've been asked to do it again by the government in Mexico City. We're probably going to be doing that as a roadshow every 8 to 10 weeks, somewhere around the world.
Okay.
Been an advisor to Startup Chile for years on startup culture. What's happening there is pretty amazing.
Hmm.
Frankly, I'm more excited about what's happening overseas in terms of startups, in terms of the potential to actually make huge, significant change in people's lives, than I am necessarily about the next greatest photo sharing app. Not that nothing's wrong with photo sharing apps, I would rather work with companies solving safety concerns or fraud in payments. In Mexico, 6% of all financial transactions online are fraudulent.
Wow, that's a huge number.
Huge!
Yeah.
And that's a giant pain in the ass. And someone is going to make a shit ton of money solving that problem.
Yeah.
And at that point, they move the economy.
Mm-hmm.
That's really
and
just
perception of the
exactly.
economy.
Absolutely.
Outside of Mexico.
And so I'm actually, like, the price of computing is getting down to the point where you can get a Raspberry Uno for $5.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's a full Linux PC.
Yep.
And now you can actually have someone who makes $1,000 a month or $500 a month afford a little PC. And you have to have an HDMI cable and a monitor and a keyboard, but the prices on those come down, you're going to be able to have people of very modest means learning how to program and build technology tools.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing, like, a startup that I just met in Chile, they want to build like an X-ray remote radiology system, but remote cardiology, remote specialist system for people in emerging markets.
Okay.
So that I can take an X-ray and a radiologist 100 miles away in the city can actually read it for me and give me advice as a specialist. Their goal is to build this system out for $1 per year per patient. They already have 3.5 million patients on their system in Chile and in Peru.
Yeah, can we bring that here?
This is what I'm talking
about.
I would
love that.
Yes.
I have personal experience with some issues with that. Wrist surgery, like, didn't need to happen, but we were a little slow in the diagnosis.
Oh, my gosh. That's awful. But, like, I think that there's going to be these amazing, there are these amazing innovations that are happening, solving, like, really cool problems. Like, if they can actually scale that company globally, they improve people's health worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's
huge.
Like, in terms of an engineer, like, I want to do things that actually make a difference, that move things. Like, I like to build big machines that matter. And ultimately, like, I kind of obsess about economics as kind of a machine, and, like, as entrepreneurship and startups is, like, a really good, you know, dynamo inside of that machine. And if we can just get more and more of those dynamos to, like, not die and keep on working and keep on growing, I think ultimately we can actually improve world economy.
It's cool. It's a good way to think about it. Very broad, big.
Crazy.
Yeah.
But you know, what else am I going to do?
Well, what else do you see as other flywheels outside of maybe just startups, or if we look at certain pieces of startups, like,
mm-hmm.
we're at a machine learning conference today. Is
mm-hmm.
that one flywheel that you see? What is other stuff?
I mean, the prices of, you know, computation are decreasing still exponentially. The time that it actually takes to build a product is the biggest cost. And so I think the advent of cloud and readily accessible cloud at very low prices is providing the people ability to have the same kind of compute resources as anybody else in the world. App stores, I think, have been a huge distribution mechanism. I ran into a company in Uruguay. It was three people. They had a Flash game. They ported to iOS, Android, and it became one of the top tower defense games in 40 countries. And the day they flipped on in-app payments in their game, they made $250,000.
One day.
One day. A three-person team in Uruguay.
Yeah.
Now they have a game shop of like 250 or 25 people. And, you know, these people are going to be the smart angels mm-hmm. that are going to start seed investing the rest of the world. Or the rest of the startups in their area.
Yeah.
And I think that's incredibly cool. And those kind of distribution mechanisms have just never been available in the history of the world before. Mm-hmm. Like, that's really cool. I mean, it's still the internet.
Yeah.
Connectivity. You know, one of our companies is using UHF free radio frequency to transmit data now.
Okay.
They're one of four companies licensed to do that.
Cool.
They can actually transmit data like 20 to 30, 40 kilometers in the spectrum very quickly and very efficiently. So what that means is that the price is decreasing. The price for that last mile of connectivity is decreasing several orders of magnitude.
And the ability.
Mm-hmm.
Like even I mean, radio waves, I'm assuming, is a lot easier to set than fiber or whatever else mm-hmm. you would do in mm-hmm. a developing country. Like.
And
that's awesome.
It's really cool. They're working on I don't know if this is public or not, but they're working on, with a very large organization that has promised a country connectivity to a lot of villages, they're actually doing pilots and bringing wireless internet to these villages that have never been connected before. And they think that they can do it at like 25 cents per user per month.
Like you're saying, complete life-changing,
absolutely.
Country-changing, village-changing, city-changing mm-hmm. technology.
And
that's awesome.
I mean, in economic development, if someone actually gets online, their income tends to improve by 20%.
Hmm.
Just getting connected to the net.
The ability to learn.
Yeah.
It speeds up so fast. I think that's a fascinating thing. When you're looking at like people who used to have to go and read books, go to the library and everything mm-hmm. else. Now you can just log on, search, find, and learn
mm-hmm.
within seconds and minutes.
And for me, you know, a friend of mine was actually helped create wireless data in a telco in Africa like 10 years ago. And he was just like, Jonathan, one of the best moments in my life was I had just helped out this telco build this huge network. And I was just walking in this village. And this farmer came up to me. He's like, hey, come here. He's like, what? I didn't know the guy. He's like, come here. Look, I just checked the prices of corn in the village. He's like, yeah.
Okay.
He's like, the price yesterday was lower. I think the price is going to continue going up. He's like, so what would you do? He's like, I'm going to wait a week and see what happens. It's like, how long would it take you to go to the village and find that out? Oh, it's like, it's 2 days. I have to carry my sacks of maize 2 days, and then I try to sell it, and I come back. And he's just like, Jonathan, like, he can now make 10 to 15% more margin on his maize.
Yeah.
Like, and he was also excited that he could have his brother in the village recharge his minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So he no longer had to go on back. He's like, dude, that's like a 20% productivity boost.
Yeah.
In a very poor farmer. If you can do that towards hundreds of thousands or millions of people in poor countries, it's like you grow the economy by 20%. Like, it's that sort of stuff that I completely like nerdgasm about.
Yeah.
And that's
awesome.
Yeah. I mean, it comes from growing up in an emerging country. I was the only white kid at the end of 6 hours of dirt road in rural Honduras. My parents ran a school. And I came back to the States when I was 14. So a lot of my passion comes from that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm actually really passionate about the power of technology to improve people's lives and in significant ways. So if we don't screw it up, I think that's what we're going to do with Hackers and Founders.
Cool. I don't think you're going to screw it up. So far, so good. And yeah. It's only been growing, and we're always very happy to be able to talk.
You guys have been a great partner. I really appreciate it.
It's been great.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks, Jonathan. Appreciate it. Always good talking.
Absolutely, sir.
Jonathan Nelson, Hackers and Founders.
Cheers.